You are listening to a recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute on October 14, 2010. The event was titled Selling to Korea, Manufacturing and the Chorus FTA, and featured the speakers Frank Vargo, Nick Yaksich, and Sage Chandler. The event was moderated by Troy Stangerone.
Good morning. My name is Troy Stangerone, and I'm the Director of Congressional Affairs and Trade at the Korea Economic Institute. I'd like to welcome you to KAEI. And I know it's been a challenging morning with the weather and everything. I hear traffic is really bad out there. The genesis for this program is sort of to take and look at the FTA and see what it does. And while I think we've all heard a lot of discussion about the auto issue, it's sort of the large elephant in the room which tends to take and clot out any light on the rest of manufacturing. And so what I wanted to take and hopefully do with this is to not necessarily avoid the issue of autos, but to actually take and try and provide some discussion of what the agreement actually means for the larger context of manufacturing in general. Because I think at times we tend to associate autos and manufacturing as one and the same, and that's not necessarily always the case. And to do that, we have a very excellent panel with us this morning, and I'll briefly go through their bios, which you all have in a larger extent in front of you, and then I will turn things over to our panelists. Frank Vargo, to my left, is the Vice President for International Economic Affairs at the National Association of Manufacturers, and he's the association's chief spokesperson on trade issues. He's responsible for working with NAM's 14,000 member companies to obtain congressional and executive branch trade policies that benefit America's manufacturers. Mr. Vargo is considered one of Washington's outstanding trade experts and is widely quoted in the press as a recurring witness at congressional hearings on trade. Prior to joining NAM, he had a three-decade trade policy career at the U.S. Department of Commerce, where he served at various positions, including as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Asia, and he also received the President's Distinguished Executive Award, the highest recognition a career government executive can receive. To my right, Nick Yaksich manages the Washington Office of the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, a trade group of more than 800 construction, agricultural, mining, and forestry equipment manufacturers and related business services. He has more than 20 years of federal government relations experience, primarily in the transportation sector. Prior to joining AEM, he was Director of Government Affairs at the National Asphalt Pavement Association and managed the Associated General Contractors National Highway Construction Division. In addition, he previously worked for Congressman Jim Oberstar of Minnesota. Sage Chandler is the Senior Director for International Trade for the Consumer Electronics Association. She's responsible for legislative policy, legislation, negotiation matters affecting the 2,100 members of the Consumer Electronics Association. Prior to joining CEA in October 2006, she served for a decade in international trade with the United States government. For nearly 6 years, she worked within the International Trade Administration of the U.S. Department of Commerce, specializing in Southeast Asian affairs. She also served under two administrations of the Office of the United States Trade Representative as the Director for Canadian Affairs. So, as you can see, we have a panel that covers a wide range of manufacturing interests and also a wide range of government and industry experience as well. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Vargo.
Thank you. Can I just speak from here? You want me
to? That's fine. Wherever you're most comfortable.
I'll go to the podium. You know, you're never too old to learn something, and I just learned this morning that when you have an inkjet printer, you can't let the papers exposed to the rain.
Well, good morning. It's a great privilege to be here, particularly with Nick and with Sage, and I'm really honored to be on a panel with them. There has been, for too long, a misunderstanding about manufacturing and the Korea agreement, and it's a widely held view that this agreement is not good for manufacturing and that we oughtn't to go into it, and that's absolutely untrue. This is a great agreement for manufacturers. It's very important to manufacturers, and we need to get it implemented as quickly as we can for reasons that I will explain. But I do note that the National Association of Manufacturers, from the very first day after the agreement was signed, noted the distress of some parts of the U.S. auto industry in feeling that there has to be something more, particularly in non-tariff barriers affecting autos in the agreement. And I think we all know that until the auto issue and the beef issue are resolved, the agreement will not move forward. But I'm optimistic. Demetrius Marantis and Wendy Cutler have been meeting with stakeholders in the U.S. They've started meeting with Korean officials. And I'm optimistic that those two issues will be resolved on the president's timetable so the agreement can be submitted up to the Hill. This agreement is arguably the most important since NAFTA. And people say, NAFTA? You know, we've lost 5 million jobs since NAFTA, implying a causality there. But the causality is not there. And it is there's equal causality if I say, you know, since NAFTA, 30 million American kids, maybe 40 million, have come down with acne. But, you know, our manufactured goods trade deficit with NAFTA did not increase at all after the year 2000 when we started losing those 5 million jobs. And before 2000, we actually, for the first time in a long time, gained jobs. So NAFTA was a good agreement. And with NAFTA, CAFTA, and all our other trade agreements, we have a manufactured goods trade surplus. We sell more manufactured goods to them than we buy from them. This is the brightest part of the U.S. trade picture, and we certainly would like to add Korea into that group. Why is Korea important? Well, it's the world's 13th largest economy, and it has an import market of $250 billion a year of manufactured goods, a quarter of $1 trillion of manufactured goods. So that's why American manufacturers would like to have a stronger presence in Korea. And moreover, the Korean market for imported manufactured goods for the last 10 years has been growing an average of 15% a year. That's pretty good, and we hope it continues. And 15% a year is what the United States has to do if we are going to meet the administration's goal of doubling exports in 5 years, which we think is quite possible. And it's not just a few companies, manufacturers, who view Korea as important. There are 21,000 American companies, according to the Census Bureau, that export to Korea. 90% of them are small and medium-sized firms. And per firm, they average $600,000 a year. That's pretty good business for a small company. So we'd like to have that grow. Now, so Korea is important. Why is the agreement important? Well, it will provide the access that we want to this sophisticated and rapidly growing market. Of course, it'll cut tariffs. It will also, very importantly, improve intellectual property protection, which is vital for American manufacturers. We will never be the world's low-cost producer. We always depend upon our innovation and our technology, and we have to have it protected. Non-tariff barriers, which have been particularly onerous in Korea, and I had up close and personal experience with that when I was the DAS for Asia at the Department of Commerce. Investor protections. Facilitating customs clearance, improving government procurement. So there are so many things that are beneficial. Now, manufactured goods are 80% of all of our merchandise exports to Korea, so this agreement is particularly important for manufacturers. Right now, in 2008, because we had a little dip, and everybody did in 2009, we exported $27 billion of manufactured goods to Korea, despite the fact that we have these trade barriers that we face, and including the fact that Korea's average import duty on manufactured goods comes out to just about 8%, which is a significant barrier. Now, compare that 8% with the import duty on Korean manufacturers to the United States, which average less than 2%, 1.4%, according to the latest figures from the Census Bureau. And, you know, that's really not a significant barrier. It's barely a speed bump. So we're quite open. And we face part of the famous unlevel playing field, and we would like to level it. I might also note that 60% of Korea's imports to the United States last year, or U.S. imports from Korea, came in totally duty-free. So we do have an imbalance. And the agreement would eliminate 95% of Korea's industrial tariffs to American manufacturers within 3 years. You know, that's pretty good. Now, the International Trade Commission has estimated that would generate that the agreement can generate about $11 billion of additional exports, and about $7 billion of that would be manufactured goods. A very broad range of manufacturers will benefit. I looked at the trade data for Korea, and it's very dispersed among all manufacturing sectors. A lot of electrical machinery, pumps, compressors, power generating equipment, lifting and loading equipment, and these will all benefit. But particularly in looking at the tariffs and looking at our export structure, the NAM thinks that chemicals and industrial machinery will be particularly strong beneficiaries. But there's more to the agreement than just cutting tariffs. The intellectual property, as I said, is very important, and Korea The Korean agreement is the best yet. It's the gold standard or the platinum standard, except I looked at the newspapers yesterday, and with the price of corn, presumably you could say it's the corn standard. The agreement has provisions to criminalize counterfeiting, and we have major problems in some other countries in which counterfeiting is basically a civil penalty with a very small financial penalty, a slap on the wrist. So criminalizing counterfeiting is extremely important. And there are customs provisions in the agreement that allows Korean customs agents to seize suspected counterfeit goods, even in free trade zones, which is a very important improvement, and without even having to wait for complaints from their rights holders, who frequently don't know that their goods are being ripped off or that they're being transshipped through a free trade zone. Then there are the non-tariff barriers. And again, these have been, and I think remain, very serious in Korea. And the agreement provides a way for addressing them. There's a sea change in transparency. Korea has been very opaque when it comes to its regulations and trade barriers, and the agreement provides ample time, 60 days for consultation. The Korean government will have to publish all the comments it receives on proposed regulations. And when Korea recognizes non-government bodies for testing and certification, it is required to provide national treatment for U.S. testing and certification bodies. So properly implemented, what this means is that U.S. companies can have their products tested in the U.S. once to both U.S. and Korean standards if they're different, and not have to be tested again in Korea, greatly reducing the cost of market entry, particularly important for small companies. The agreement also contains a Technical Barriers to Trade Committee, a TBT committee, to view how the agreement is working, provide a forum for discussion. This is a very important committee, and much depends upon how it will be implemented after the agreement. If it just sits there and meets once every 5 years, you know, this, we will not see the full measure of what this agreement can produce. But if it's a very active agreement, and the NAM, and I'm sure other associations are impressed that the committee be very robust, and that if new non-tariff barriers emerge, that this they are raised to the attention of the committee right away. And we would certainly not hesitate to press USTR to bring about denial of national treatment or other cases to the dispute settlement provisions that are in the agreement if need be. Additionally, the agreement contains excellent investor state provisions and other investment provisions, and I know these were very hard to negotiate, but they're very important because if you look at world investment patterns and trading patterns, export patterns, you'll see the companies export where they invest. You have facilities, you have warehousing, distribution, marketing. That's where you're going to sell, but you need the investment protections. But there's a new imperative, of course, for completing the agreement quickly, and that is that the European Union has completed its agreement, and the Council of Ministers has ratified it. It only remains for the Parliament, which will happen. Not sure exactly when the agreement will go into effect. Pardon me, I don't get very many miles to the cup. Don't know exactly when it'll go into effect, but sometime between January and July it is likely to be in effect. And since we compete head-to-head with the European Union, our export profile to Korea is very similar to that of the European Union. This is a real problem, particularly since the European Union is already Korea's largest supplier. 15% of Korea's manufactured imports come from the European Union, as opposed to 11% the United States. Now, what happens when EU products get in duty-free and with the other advantages that European producers will have in the Korean market when their agreement goes into effect? You know, they will not be facing an 8% import duty. They will have other benefits. Well, in the European Union's estimation, they will pick up an additional $25 billion of exports. That's not only goods, that includes services, but a substantial amount of goods, and including manufactured goods. And they see a 6% increase in their share of Korea's imports. So if their figures are anywhere near right, their share goes up, somebody's share is going to go down. And who might that be? Well, it's going to be the United States. Again, because our goods are very substitutable for European goods. So we're in the crosshairs here, and we cannot afford to be in the position of having Korean importers and Korean manufacturers designing out U.S. components and using European components. We must be in this market. It's a very important market. It's also very important strategically. Doug Gowdy, the NAM's trade policy director, is in Korea now with a group of associations and companies meeting with Korean officials, and is doing a daily blog. And I encourage you to go to the NAM website and look at that. He did a particularly poignant one yesterday on the strategic importance of this trade agreement, because Korea and the United States have been and remain very, very good and very close friends. We need to have a strong presence in the Pacific. We cannot just cede the Pacific to China strategically, politically, economically. And Korea wants that tie with the United States, so the strategic dimension is very important also, and important to manufacturers, because we need stability, we need growth in the Pacific. And Korea needs to be just the start. We also have Colombia and Panama pending. Those agreements need to be acted on as quickly as possible, but we can't just stop there. Now, we are negotiating, the U.S. is negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that would add market access in New Zealand, Brunei, Vietnam, and Malaysia. As just indicated, it will join, and other countries are looking at it. But even that is not enough. We look at the European Union, and they never met a trade agreement they didn't like. You know, here we are, two very high-cost producers in the United States and Europe. Actually, Europe is a higher-cost producer than the United States. But we cringe and wring our hands over, should we conclude a trade agreement with Panama? You know, in a good year, going downhill with the wind behind its back, Panama will export as much manufactured goods to us in a year as China does every 4 hours. You know, what's the problem? And of course, it's not economic. It's all political and strategic with the labor unions. But if we're going to double exports, we've got to have agreements with Brazil, with India, Malaysia, Thailand, UAE, Saudi Arabia. And these are all countries that the European Union is negotiating with now. So we can double exports. You know, we can be very competitive in the world if we have more market access, and we can get it, but we have to totally change our attitudes, and we need to start by recognizing that for not just for farmers and services providers, but for manufacturers, particularly once the two remaining issues are resolved, this is a great agreement. So thank you very much. Now, I've got to leave a little early. You want me to take some questions?
Yes, I was going to say, Mr. Varga has to depart a little early, so if there's any questions for him specifically, why don't we go ahead and take those now? Oh, I'll go ahead and start off. I actually have something I was thinking about. After President Obama and President Lee announced they wanted to move forward on CORUS, at CSIS there was an event where Kurt Tong, the U.S. Ambassador to APEC, made a comment that one of the reasons for moving forward was that it was a way to show our TPP partners that the United States could move forward on trade. If we're unable to take and move forward with CORUS, what does that do not only to the TPP, but the broader U.S. manufacturing perspective in Asia?
Well, it certainly does not step on the accelerator. There is a lot of question, I think, about the U.S. ability to conclude agreements that has not. I have not seen any effect on the TPP negotiations yet. The United States is really, we're such a large market, we're crucial to negotiations. But if the Korea agreement is not brought forward, by the end of November, something like that, yes, I think this will have a chilling effect. I would like to think the agreement will go up and it will be voted on in lame duck, but having been around the block a few times, lame ducks don't do as much as people would like them to do, and they really tend to focus on appropriations and budgets, and I suspect that that's likely to be the case this time, even though I would like it to be different.
Joe.
Yes, sir. You've had a lot of experience in dealing with the Congress over the years. Could you give your assessment of likely congressional attitudes? I mean, even today, even a year ago, at the time the agreement was initialed, Pelosi and Sandy Levin with Charlie Rangel standing there with his arm twisted behind his back, gave a strong statement saying, well, we don't like this for a lot of different reasons. And there's no reason to think that the Democratic Party is going to be any more in favor of a trade agreement with Korea in the spring of 2012 than it has been all along. And if the automobile manufacturers dig in their heels, particularly Ford, what is the chance that even if Ron Kirk is able to find the pony and the president says, yes, we want to go forward, what how do you assess the prospects?
Well, of course, the remarkable thing about the future is it's unknown. So you have to make some assumptions. And I assume that Ron Kirk and the U.S. negotiating team and the Koreans will come to a satisfactory resolution to the two remaining issues. And the president has said once that happens, then he will send it up. Again, I think the lame duck is as much as I would like to see it then, I think it's going to be early next year. Now, who knows who's going to be in charge of the House, et cetera. But either way, you do it. You know, let's assume that the Democrats keep the House. The difference is if a Democrat president sends it to a Democrat House and tells the Speaker of the House, this is my agreement now, I want it, yeah, it'll go through. The votes are there, you know, by our count of the votes in both parties, it could be brought up any time and it would pass. But it's not going to pass as long as the majority leadership is opposed to it. But I believe that that will change once the president sends it up. So I think the chances are quite good.
Yeah, Emory.
Frank, can you talk a little bit about this trip that Doug is on? What's the purpose, the goal of this trip, and also who they're meeting with while they're there?
The purpose of the trip is to show the interest of the U.S. business community in moving forward with this agreement. That it's they're meeting with Korean business, they're meeting with the president of Korea, meeting with ministers. They just took a trip up to the DMZ, which is why the poignant blog yesterday, because it's necessary to reinforce the support that the business community has for this agreement. So that's the purpose of the trip.
Yeah, Amy.
Hi, Frank. I wanted to ask two questions. One thing I heard was Stanley Levin say, as much as manufacturing as a whole is huge, really a large part of the U.S. trade deficit with Korea is in autos. So we really just, that has to be resolved and the rest of it. So I'm a little curious to have you compare the role of autos and the role of manufacturing as a whole, which I think you did, but a little bit more detail.
Oh, there's no question. You look at the statistics, and the largest part of our trade deficit with Korea, indeed, is in autos. And that's one reason why some of the U.S. auto companies want to change some of the non-tariff barriers to help adjust that. But the overall manufactured goods balance with Korea can be brought into closer balance in other manufacturing sectors. So it's good for manufacturing overall. But again, the auto companies do have their issues, and they've been working with USTR, and I'm optimistic those will be resolved.
So you do see the auto industry as capable of having a resolution that they're satisfied with?
Yes, I do. They're working with USTR, and I am optimistic that a further solution, you know, perhaps a side agreement, perhaps something else, I don't know, is doable, and I'm optimistic it will be achieved.
Yeah, Eric.
Eric Watson, Inside U.S. Trade. Frank, how crucial is this G20 deadline? If we don't get things buttoned up by then, are we at risk of a slippery slope of not getting it done, or what's your view?
How crucial is the deadline? Well, you know, the world doesn't come to an end then. You know, it might in 2012, but it doesn't then. But the deadline has been stated. Deadlines are good. Deadlines are what keep things moving forward. So it's very important. And I know that Demetrius Marantis and Wendy Cutler take it very seriously. And much depends upon the Korean reaction, but I know that the Korean government wants the agreement very much, so I'm going to be optimistic and say I think the deadline can be met.
Rich Patrick. I'm just curious. I think China is the largest trade partner with Korea now, and how do you see U.S. manufacturers competing with the Chinese industry?
So far, we don't. We have a different product mix. China make China. You know, about half of China's exports are from the processing zones. They are basically assembled electronics and others from inputs from Korea, from Malaysia, and other places. The other half, China yet does not compete with the the sort of sophisticated machine tools, the power generating equipment, other capital goods equipment that the United States makes. And our principal competition in Korea for those, again, is the European Union. Now, China, of course, with its indigenous innovation policy and other industrial policies, is seeking to move up the ladder of manufacturing sophistication. But still, for the most part, China tends to be in the more labor-intensive, what we might call commodity manufacturers or unbranded manufacturers. That may change in the future. And how the United States copes with that is really up to us. If the Congress takes a more positive attitude towards manufacturing and starts to look more seriously at the problems we face, you know, a lack of skilled labor for the future, a lack of scientists and engineers, one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, you know, if that stays, I don't know. But if Congress stops looking at manufacturing and saying, you know, your only problem is trade agreements, no more trade agreements, your problem is fixed, that blinds them to really looking at what manufacturing's real problems are. And we do have serious problems, and we can address them. Doug, I saw your hand up.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you already covered in your speech, so I hate to make you go over it again. But what exactly is going on in the negotiations? I mean, Demetrius and Kim met over the weekend, but USTR says the U.S. didn't give them any proposals. I mean, do you expect it? I mean, and then when I ask them, they say, well, of course, at some point we'll give them a proposal. But, I mean, the G20 is less than 3 weeks away. Mm-hmm. I mean, when do you expect them to actually seriously engage in negotiations? Or is that already going on and they're just not fessing up to it?
Well, you know, Doug, because I'm a registered lobbyist, and I got kicked off my ITAC, so I don't know. I really don't.
This is the last question right here.
The Heritage Foundation. My question has to deal with the increase in exports in the manufacturing sector. The big word this election year is jobs. So do you have a number as to the benefits in terms of how many jobs will be present in the U.S. As a result of passing the agreement?
Well, if we picked up an additional $7 billion, that would be, 60, 70,000 jobs, something like that. These numbers are all very, very goosey, but the Commerce Department tries to every year look at exports and jobs, and that probably is not a bad estimate. But the thing about Korea, again, I don't view it as an entity in itself once we get the Korea agreement, we're done. This is part of a continuum that we have to keep moving forward on trade agreements, or we're out. And we have estimated, and looking at how you double exports, that we need, that if we left exports alone, that by 2014, 5 years, we'd have maybe $1.5 trillion of manufactured exports. But the goal of doubling is $1.8 trillion. That's a $300 billion gap. No way to make up that gap without more trade agreements and get those trade agreements pretty quickly. We figure that if we did trade agreements with most of the significant economies in the world, or all economies that might be eligible, that we could pick up as much as $100 billion extra in exports, because there's so many trade barriers around the world. So Korea is very important in itself, but it's also important as one stop along the way towards getting U.S. exporters to have market access. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you, Tor, for the opportunity to be here. I am Nick Yaksik. I'm Vice President of Global Public Policy for the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. The problem sitting there listening and following Frank is he pretty much can cover the world and cover the topics insightfully and comprehensively on a number of the topics that I was going to discuss. Because we do share our views and similar views with the National Association of Manufacturers. NAM has, I think I was talking about 260 like groups like us, the association, little slices of NAM. And so I'll focus my comments on our sector. And we represent about 800 equipment manufacturers in the construction, agriculture, mining, and forestry area. And again, you know, listen to Frank, too. I was sitting there, too. I, too, and I think it was in my bio, an older bio, was sent over. I, too, used to be a member of the ITAC and on capital goods and was kicked off because I am a registered lobbyist, as was Frank.
So. It's a former club.
Yeah, we have this new club. But it's changed, and I think it's kind of symbolic, too, of working with this administration. And then I think the end point, too, is the importance, the overall importance of this free trade agreement for our sector is that we need to keep this momentum going on free trade. And the Korea agreement is front and center, and we hope for some momentum to get it passed. What I want to do is just kind of briefly do about four things. Talk a little bit about the association, give you kind of in context again of our industry and our economic look to put in context of the importance of the exports, and then talk a little bit about what our association is doing. And one of the issues, the questions over here was about jobs. Talk a little bit about job and job creations, because there is a definite political tie there that is a disconnect, and trying to make that connection is a challenge in the trade world. And then I'll talk a few comments specifically on the free trade agreement with Korea and what I see in that agreement is beneficial to our sector. But as an association, when I started 10, 12 years ago, coming from the construction side, I was talking to one of our members who produce, and our members produce from large earth-moving equipment to anything that you can kind of throw in the back of a pickup truck or on a farm. And I was talking to a member who is a concrete saw manufacturer out of Kansas, and I was thinking, oh, he probably just works in the concrete states of Kansas, Oklahoma, Iowa, and that area, big concrete states. And he goes, Nick, I'm selling all over the world. You know, he said, I have one little plant here, but, you know, it is dependent on me to have global market, global access to sell my product worldwide. And it dawned on me, too, as Frank mentioned, too, that it's just, you know, the public perception is just the large companies. It's these small companies that see a significant increase in their exports. They're not going to go build a plant somewhere else and move their jobs there, but going to sell products worldwide is going to be a significant impact on their revenue and a significant impact on their job creation. So for us and our association, I mean, we work hard looking at tariffs and eliminating tariffs. Intellectual property rights, which talked about, is very key, and we work with the administration on that, protecting those intellectual property rights. And two, also, as Frank mentioned, barriers. We have standards on acronyms that I can't even begin to imagine, TS-127s, 126. You know, these companies and hydraulic crane operators travel in every corner of the world, you know, talking about standards and harmonization of standards. So trade is key and kind of in forefront in our association. Now, in terms of the economy and where we are in the context, if you understand, in 2008, 2009, we basically just stopped on the construction, mainly on the construction side. Ag did not see the drop-off, mainly because of housing and the housing market just kind of killed the construction equipment. When you have aerial work platforms, you know, used in residential construction, housing, their market dropped 80-90%. You know, in 2008, 2009. You look at road building business and compactors that fell 50, 60% in their market. Cement trucks, a company of ours used to sell 3,500 cement trucks a year. Now they're selling just over 100 cement trucks a year. So you're talking about keeping manufacturing going, keeping your supply chain going, keeping jobs. It's a very challenging time for our sector. Employment. We mentioned 550,000 jobs were lost in our sector between our distribution and our manufacturers from 2008 to 2009. And I remember seeing one of our CEOs on television, it was on CNBC, just kind of at 2008, it was August of 2008, and the North American market did struggle, and that was the line of questioning. He goes, well, fortunately, we're a global company, and kind of had a big smile on his face. You know, we're a global company. And then in late 2008 into 2009, the rest of the world struggled, not as much, and his company struggled on a global competitive basis. So it's a difficult time, but again, in 2010, we are seeing some uptick. I think in 2009, our members cut their personnel. They cut their production down to bare bones. I've been surprised that I haven't seen as much consolidations or layoffs or plant closings as you would expect when you lose 80, 90% of your market. So 2010 is seeing a slow uptick. We testified before the House Transportation Committee a couple of weeks ago, and you know, and our CEO made the point that, you know, our uptick is, we were here in 2006, 2007, we're down here now. So our uptick is coming from here, you know, a very low trough, but we're seeing some increase in demand, increase in employment, and increase in inventories, which is helping our sector grow. The stimulus, too, the misconception of the stimulus, and I know Korea, too, has a stimulus program going in their construction market. To help us as construction equipment manufacturers, it didn't help. You know, our members need a long-term investment. They need contractors, their customers, to be able to plan one bridge project. A contractor's not going to go out and buy a crane or buy a roller to repave the bridge. If he has 6 years of bridge work, he's going to go out and buy a crane, go out and buy a roller. So we continue to make that case that we need these long-term plans. Stimulus funding helps keep our members and our customers afloat, but it doesn't really trickle down to the manufacturing sector. But in 2010, what's important, what's helped, and we're seeing more and more in all of our surveys and discussions, is the exports side. You know, the U.S. construction market continues to be flat. We cannot get a highway bill or significant investment in infrastructure, and our members now are looking around the world and increasing their exports, and that has helped their growth and helped them remain in business and remain vibrant. So we continue to look and for opportunities to reduce tariffs and work through different free trade agreements, and obviously the Korea is front and center in congressional eyes. What we're doing, too, in terms of trying to bring awareness to this issue is we started two separate campaigns. Back in 2008, 2009, we had what we called a Start Us Up USA campaign, working with our construction equipment dealers. And what we basically did with our members in five or six different cities is we loaded idle construction equipment on the back of flatbed trucks and circled the city and basically tried to shut down traffic to bring attention to the issue. And we did one here. We didn't need to shut down traffic here in D.C. It happens by itself. But we brought a number of congressional members, you know, to Capitol Hill and down on the Hill and talking about the idle equipment that's out there. And we need to put investment out, increase trade to get this equipment to work. Right now we have a campaign going. It's I Make America. And it's focused on not necessarily on creating jobs here in America through two means. Infrastructure investment, and exports. And we had a launch on September 29th with Mike Rowe, who's in the Dirty Jobs fame. And so we've been working closely with him on that point of trying to put a face to trade and the fact that these are real people who are out there building these goods, manufactured goods that are shipped around the world. We've used flip cans, trying to do social media. And so our focus has been not necessarily on the welder or the person working in the shop, but it's the coffee shop owner down the street that's serving all the John Deere employees. You know, it's the barber shop and the tourist people in Peoria, Illinois that are working with Caterpillar. So we're trying to aggressively work with Congress on making this case that it's people, it's jobs, indirect jobs are being created through free trade. What we look at when we talk about free trade, too, is a couple key kind of overriding issues, and Frank hit on these, too, is the competitiveness of AAM members. We're willing, able, and want to compete in a global marketplace. Our association, 800 members, we have Chinese, we have Korean members. We have members that just believe in the free marketplace, and they're looking for level playing fields, you know, around the globe to compete. Also, too, I mentioned in the difficult time, too, with the supply chain. I mean, it's a global supply chain. Any interruption into that supply chain can wreak havoc. I think kind of what's the game that's being played now with manufacturers is if there is going to be an uptick, when and how much do I invest now in my steel, my tires, my rubber, my components, if there is going to be an uptick so I'm prepared. So the global supply chain is critical for our members going forward. But specifically for us on the construction and agriculture side, in the late 90s, we had the Uruguay round in negotiation in our sectors on zero-for-zero tariff. And South Korea played a part of that negotiations with, I think, 12, 15 different countries, you know, where there's agreement on zero for zero in their tariffs on construction and agriculture equipment. Now, within the Korea Free Trade Agreement, there are a couple products there that we have that still go up to 8% in their tariffs. And so this agreement would wipe that out. And it's mainly in the one that comes to mind is agriculture equipment, agriculture tractors, that we would see that eliminated. Frank also mentioned the agreement with the EU. That, again, hurts our competitiveness as we're falling behind in our ability to compete around the world. India also has an agreement with Korea recently, I believe, last 5-10 years, and there's a major tractor manufacturer there that has advantages that some of our U.S. companies don't here in the United States. So we're continuing to push for that agreement for the removal of the tariffs. I think the other thing, too, we saw in this agreement, the FTA, which we've been pushing since Chile and before, is remanufactured goods. There is equipment and kind of a misperception out here. Our companies can take a piece of equipment, a big piece of equipment, pull that equipment out of service, take the engine out, refurbish, replant, re-energize it, and send it back out on that market as good or better before than what they brought in. So this agreement also allows the sale and expansion of remanufactured goods, which is critical to some of our members, too. And I think lastly, too, again, is we want to compete in every marketplace around the world, whether it's through stimulus funding, the construction market, the agriculture benefits that come to the Korean market. Our members want to be able to compete in this marketplace. On the agriculture side, Korea market is one of the top 10 growth markets for agriculture equipment, and this free trade agreement would significantly help remove some of those barriers. And I think lastly, in conclusion, I see this, too, and I agree with everything that Frank said, too. It's almost symbolic to this agreement. I mean, the administration has said through the National Export Initiative that we want to double exports. Now it's time to kind of walk the talk. This agreement, you know, I was going to say earlier, I think everything's been said on this agreement, but not everyone's had the chance to say it. So I think it's ready for prime time, ready to move forward. And it's very symbolic that I've seen different lists of what's on the lame duck to be considered. Some lists, the Korean Free Trade is on there. The mechanics of getting it done will be a challenge. It'll take the political will to get it done after the election. But we think it would be an important step, fully support the Korean FTA. And we think it's important for this administration to continue to show the leadership to the rest of the world that we're serious about trade. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Now we'll turn it over to Sage.
Thank you, Nick, and to the Institute for having me here. I'm going to speak to you about the consumer electronics industry. We're a $165 billion U.S. industry, and I'm the trade director for the Consumer Electronics Association, and we represent about 2,100 corporate members from all over the world, many U.S. companies, but also many international companies. We sponsor and manage the Consumer Electronics Show, which is out in Las Vegas. Many of you have probably been there. We had 130 countries represented last year at the show. It is truly an international show. 125,000 attendees. What's important about those numbers is that we don't just let anybody in off the street to the show. Only buyers and sellers are there. So all of the people who are at that show are there to do business. And that is always very important when we're talking about foreign delegations which come to that show, many of which are Korean and many of the companies are Korean companies. Consumer electronics play a significant role in the average American life. Back in 1975, the average American household had only one device. Now we estimate that there are about 25 consumer electronic devices in every household. That is your cell phone, your TV, your computer, your iPad, pretty much every gadget that you're using on a daily basis to communicate, to do work, to play with, your Xboxes and so on. We're America's largest export sector, about $220 billion, And we make up about 21% of total U.S. exported goods. That was 2006 figures, but the number is about the same. We are one of the world's most globally integrated industries. Ability for the United States and our industry specifically to enter into, well, for the United States to enter into free trade agreements and for our companies to be a party to them by tariff reductions, non-tariff barriers. It's vital to the continued success of our industries. It's not just tariffs, it's the non-tariff barriers that make these trade agreements so important. Korea, as you all probably know, is a $1 trillion economy, and it's the United States' seventh largest trading partner. From 2001, U.S. high-tech exports to South Korea increased by 45% to $10.6 billion. That number is absolutely outstanding. When you think about, those are our exports, and they're increasing 45%. Those numbers are really significant when we're talking about the ability, especially of our smaller companies, to be able to trade overseas. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the thing that I hear almost all the time from our companies when we ask them if a trade agreement passed with Panama, with Colombia, with Korea, what do you think your business prospects would, how would they change? And they all say it would change for the better, and we have no way of telling because now business is open, and some companies are already doing business over there, and many have been priced out. The success of our industry is not guaranteed. It stems from one source, and that's a vibrant free market that encourages innovation and innovative goods and services. Innovation can be slowed, and it can be priced out of reach, and competition can be choked. And it's these government policies, governments giving businesses the ability to operate that spurs innovation. Our industry is driven by innovation, and it's innovation that keeps us moving forward. It's the changing nature of consumer electronics that keeps us propelling forward. It's interesting, we're being a globally integrated industry as we are. I'm just going to highlight one recent example of some research that was done. An iPod's retail value is about $299. There are 451 components that go into an iPod. The most expensive component inside an iPod is its hard drive. That's from Toshiba, a Japanese company that runs about $73. There are various chips ranging from $5 to $20. A couple of them, those are made in the United States, others around the world. Assembly is in China. That's about $4. There are even some parts from Korea in that iPod. But $163 of that value is assigned to the United States. That's because of the innovation, the engineering, the design, the research that goes into that product. So we're not always talking just about stuff. We're not just talking about semiconductors and chips and hard drives. We also talk, when we talk about opening markets, about keeping the innovation and the ability for intellectual property rights to be free and to be protected. South Korea's consumer electronics market is massive. We define it as the market for computing devices, mobile handsets, AV products. It's projected to be around $12.7 billion in 2010, and that's expected to increase by $12.9 billion in 2014. Here you can see some of the top imports from America. Our several CE categories. These are from the Census Bureau and the CIA World Factbook. These numbers are significant because these products were manufactured in the United States, and the exports from South Korea to the United States also include many consumer electronics. What's interesting is that you see semiconductors on both lists. We both have manufacturers of semiconductors. We're both buying and selling from each other and integrating those products into each other's design and manufacture. Growth opportunities in the mature market of Korea will be driven to a large extent by innovation. Things that, like smartphones, products that are not leapfrogging old technologies. We see a lot in our industry of developing markets in other parts of Asia and Africa where you have economies that had really no technology to speak of, and then they start leapfrogging and getting to the most developed product, but they're buying it and importing those products. Korea is quite a world player in actually designing and innovating those products and helping the industry to spur and to move forward. Computers accounted for 31% of their spending in 2009 and sales of $3.3 billion in 2010. Their domestic giants, everybody's heard about, Samsung and Lucky Gold Star, also two of our members, are driving that growth, but there is a lot of opportunity for U.S. companies, especially in gaming devices and notebooks. Now that there's emergence of netbooks, we're seeing some more innovative U.S. companies starting to move into the market as well. And they are facing tariffs ranging around 5%, some of them much higher. What was interesting to me in terms of some of the numbers when I was looking to do this presentation was that some of the annual growth rate, and the largest percentage growth that will be occurring in the next couple years, are mobile handsets, handset device sales, going to be about 47% of their spending in 2009. It was a market driven by replacements, as penetration of the mobile device market has surpassed 100%. That means that everybody in Korea, according to these numbers, owns a cell phone, or there are enough people who own two to make up for those people who don't have one. That's a fascinating number for the industry, that you are selling not new products to people who've never had them before, but you're trying to make your product better. You're trying to make it more exciting. You're trying to have new features. That's what the American market and the Korean market are all about, spurring that new innovation. The iPhone sold 800,000 units in June of 2010. We're expecting to see an emergence of a lot more technology around that kind of sale. Our growth in the Korea market is incredibly important, and without a passage of a trade agreement, we are going to linger behind. A lot of our competitors are in Europe. There are several European consumer electronics companies who are strong competitors to our companies. The course includes a commitment by Korea to permit U.S. companies within 2 years to own up to 100% of telecommunications operations in Korea. That's huge when you look at those numbers that I just had up on the iPhone sales and the telecom and the handset operations and the growth in those sectors. And there is huge growth potential for telecom operators then. Right now, there is not an easy opportunity for any of them to do business there. The chorus would make it permissible to do business. It ensures U.S. operators cost-based access to the service and facilities of dominant Korean phone companies, and letting them build networks to serve customers in Korea. We'll ensure market access for broadcasting and audiovisual service providers. I'm going to highlight a couple of those companies later. And within 3 years, 100% foreign ownership of program providers for U.S. firms that establish a Korean subsidiary. I haven't yet mentioned that other members of ours include HDTV, ESPN, the National Football League, NFL, so we have Comcast. These guys all have their eyes set on foreign markets, and the ability for broadcasting and audiovisual service providers will open up new markets to them. The non-discriminatory and duty-free treatment of all digital products, software, audiovisual, imported in physical form or over the internet is a very big step for us. Google and other search engines are our members. Having protections on them is imperative, especially with piracy and strong internet provisions. It's very important to have these provisions and for them to be comfortable moving forward. I'm sure we've all been paying some attention to what's happening in China. Troy indicated that it would be interesting to highlight a couple of our smaller companies, just so you can see some of these products that you may have never heard about. You all know our big companies like Intel and Texas Instruments and the big Korean companies like Samsung and Lucky Gold Star. But the first company I want to talk to you about is a small company called Gutammer Company. They manufacture a product called the Butt Kicker. It is a device, well, they make all kinds of devices, but basically they make your movie-going theater experience a 4D experience. We know what 3D is when you watch the with the glasses and the visuals come flying at you. 4D is when you have something attached to the chair and you actually feel what's happening in the movie. Your seat jumps up and down or shakes or vibrates and with the noise. They manufacture their product here in the United States, in Kentucky and in Ohio. These two products, the yellow and the blue one, are in Ohio. The other others are in Kentucky. These are the devices that are attached to theater chairs and home theater. They are in use in the military for training. They also actually have a lot of applications for handicapped people. I've laughed with some of the Colombians about this company, which they also export to Colombia, that they can blast their Shakira on their bass system so loud that they blow the eardrums out, and then the company can serve them with that as well, because for deaf people, they have devices that will shake your seat or your bed when your doorbell rings. Gutammer has companies and theaters all over the world. The CGV complex in South Korea is South Korea's largest Cineplex. It's like the AMC in the United States. And you may know that the trade agreement will also open up the movie industry. And that wouldn't normally be important to consumer electronics, except that a lot of products do go hand in hand with the movie industry. If right now, Korean content has to be something like, it's 40%, I believe, for half the year. The launch of the negotiations, they got that down to about 20% Korean content, which, interestingly enough, was about the same time this company got its first order in Korea. They now have theaters all over Korea. This is a picture of some of the theaters. Here's a picture of one of the Cineplexes in Seoul. They have been selling, they started off just selling a couple palletfuls and now are supplying about 300,000 units a year, and just recently started getting orders for these game, the sim racing enthusiasts. I had to have a little walkthrough from the CEO on what exactly these things were. He said the Korean market is, and I quote, going absolutely nuts over this stuff. You attach these to your chair for driving racing games, and you actually feel like you're in the cockpit of an airplane or in a car. The interesting thing in how they're marketing this product in South Korea is that it doesn't come with noise. It just shakes your seat. So for living in very tight quarters or close proximity in big cities or places where the population is much more densely populated, you don't have to worry about having your bass and the noise affect your neighbors. This thing will just shake your chair but not come with the noise. So this is a small company that manufactures here in the United States, employs a few hundred U.S. employees that are putting the stuff together in our factories, and they are selling into Korea. Their average tariff rate on their product is about 5%. They do have competition, and right now they've blocked their competition out just because they're good and they form the relationships with their suppliers, who are also manufacturers and have decided to use their product. But it's not going to be easy, especially once the European agreement goes through. And the CEO says that if these tariffs can come down, they can lower their price a little bit, and he's confident that they could get into many more complexes. And I think that with the agreement opening up movie theaters, more movie opportunity, he'll also have more opportunity. The second company I just want to highlight here is IED Audio. We're doing actually a tour of this facility in Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, with the Minister Choi of the embassy here just next week. IED does all it manufactures in Ennis, Texas, in Kentucky, and in Arizona, all of the flight data recording systems, the monitors, the audio recording systems that are in airports across the world and in 80% of the airports across the United States. You can see there a map of a lot of the airports that they've done. They're a tiny little company, well, small compared to many standards. They have three manufacturing locations, and they are working now with a couple of Korean partners. Alvis Communications has helped them get into the Korean market, and they have now outfitted Incheon Airport and have done both phase one and two of that brand new airport, and are working on phase three in the next couple of years. They have done all of the data, flight, simulation, audio in that airport as well. And they have tariffs on their products, and they do have strong competition in Germany, in the Netherlands, I believe, as well as in other areas of Asia. They got these contracts, he thought, not based just on price, but on their ability to service the airports quickly, and that's because they formed a good relationship with a Korean partner. He said the problem that he's been hearing about from his partner most recently is that they're having a hard time paying these tariffs and being competitive. So here's two examples of two small companies who have been able to beat the odds, get their products that are not necessarily the cheapest product into a foreign market, and they need the U.S. government help. And so, you know, we can look at the manufacturing industry writ large and talk about how we need components and non-tariff and tariff barriers alike removed, but it sometimes brings it to light more when you see just a couple of small companies. And that's what I'll just leave it with that, and if anybody has any questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
I have to say, I didn't expect to hear Google mentioned this morning, but now that I think back to the news of the last couple of days, where they're getting into wind farms, apparently they're going to cover every industry in the United States at some point.
Yeah.
So we'll open up to questions now from the audience. Joe, we've got a mic coming too, so just wait a moment.
This is more of a personal question. Can you buy these butt kickers as a consumer? You know, I got a grandson. It'd probably drive my daughter crazy. And it would be fun.
I'll give you my slide that has contact information.
Thank
on the
you
website.
Very much.
They're fun.
We could sell you a bulldozer, too.
Yeah, right.
Who's grandson like that?
My two-year-old's grandson's already got one. It's about this big. It's
well, that was I mentioned the stimulus, and that's what we said, our kind of message on Capitol Hill is we don't need shovel ready, we need bulldozer ready. You know, let's think big.
Yes, in the back, please.
Thank you. I'm Clyde Prestowitz. I'm president of the Economic Strategy Institute. Some of you may know me as a former U.S. trade negotiator. I actually did a lot of negotiation with Korea in the 1980s. I'm also on the advisory board of a medium-sized company in California called Form Factor. They make probe cards to test semiconductor wafers. And so I was interested in your presentation with regard to small, medium-sized companies entering the Korean market, because we're a medium-sized company, I guess about $300 million. But the story is a very interesting story. The company was founded by a guy named Igor Kondros, a refugee from Ukraine in the 1970s. Iconic story. He landed in New York, you know, penniless, went to school at night, got his PhD, Stevens Institute of Technology, went to work for IBM in their semiconductor division, and invented the probe card, which revolutionized semiconductor testing. got the venture capital, formed the company in Livermore, California in 1995. The company exports about 80% of its production to Asia. And exports a lot to Korea. In fact, Korea is one of the biggest markets. But here's the story in Korea. Initially, the company got into Korea. and did reasonably well. But then the Korean government, in conjunction with Korean industry, decided that they could make probe cards too. And so a company was formed in Korea with Korean government assistance called FICOM. And FICOM cloned the form factor product. And it was a classic example. The clone was so good that they cloned the mistakes in the product as well as the rest of the product. In fact, sometimes form factor is sent the FICOM product for repair because customers think it's the form factor product. That's how close the clone is. The clone infringed a number of form factor patents, but four key patents in particular. And so in order to respond, form factor filed complaints in Korea. Form factor's patents are worldwide. They're granted in Korea as well as in other countries. And initially, form factor filed complaints with the Korean patent office. And the Korean patent office upheld the claims. They upheld form factor's complaints, but then there was an appeal to the patent court in Korea. And the basis of the appeal was FICOM argued that the patent should be annulled. The patent court annulled three of the four key patents. But form factor still had one key patent. And so they tried to get an injunction on that one patent. But the Seoul District Court denied the injunction and, in fact, stated that that patent should be annulled, too. So we eventually got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in fact, annulled all the patents. And so form factor is now competing in Korea without protection of its intellectual property.
You know, we have that I guess.
Now, let me finish, please. And
if you could try to, like, sum up, I mean.
Well, I will sum up, but, I mean, you've had a long presentation here, and so I want to be sure you understand the situation. We had tariffs on those products, but tariffs were not a significant barrier. The barrier was not a matter of tariffs. As you all know, the exchange rates move 4 or 5% a day. The problem was intellectual property protection, which we didn't have in Korea. Our exports to Korea are significant, but they're declining because of lack of intellectual property protection. The question, I guess, is what is there in this in the new free trade agreement that would deal with this kind of a situation? Which I might add, I have a long experience in Korea. This is not unique. This happens frequently in the Korean market. And I'd like to know what is there in the agreement that would stop this.
We see patent problems quite frequently with the industry. I deal with them most frequently in the Chinese market. It's always incredibly tricky. The IP chapters essentially give the U.S. legal ground to retaliate and to protect and enforce. That's the most...
Retaliate against what?
If the Korean government is found to be in violation of its IP commitments.
It wouldn't be. In this case I just mentioned, there's no way the Korean government could be found in violation.
Well, if FICOM is a Korean government, if FICOM, you mentioned that this company called FICOM was set up by the Korean government. We've seen a similar case in Australia.
I said with the assistance of the Korean government. It's not a government company.
Well, then the company could sue in regular courts of law.
Well, that's what we did. The problem in this instance was Korean nationalism. Court officials told us they annulled the patents because if they enforced the patents, Koreans would lose their jobs. Now I'm telling you, this is not unique. This has happened frequently in Korea. Many American companies don't bother filing cases in Korean courts because they know they won't win. They take infringement of their intellectual property as a cost of doing business. Yeah.
I don't think that's unique to Korea in the sense of we face that with
not unique to Korea.
Right, we face that with companies that are, you know, and Anne-Marie works with me closely too, that come to us with an intellectual property concern, but they're unwilling to kind of go forward and challenge the government because they're looking at future market repercussions,
retaliation.
Retaliation. So
right.
It's a very, and it's not unique to
Korea. The barrier is not tariff. The barrier is the fear of retaliation. The barrier is industrial policy. The barrier is economic nationalism.
Well, but economic nationalism isn't unique to other countries. I mean, there's been a lot of Chinese investment that has been stopped in the United States for simple fact of economic nationalism.
Well, you're right, but let's look at the numbers. The U.S. has a $600 billion trade deficit. It just went to $50 billion roughly last month. You know, there may be problems in the U.S. market, but any country that has a $600 billion trade deficit can't be said to be protectionist.
Unfortunately, it's the nature of the business. A lot of the times, the companies that we see who have patents who are having similar issues, and I've had them recently in, not just in China, in Australia. I mean, in other countries with which we do have free trade agreements.
In Australia, you can go to court. In Australia, you can get an objective, unbiased ruling.
Well, bias is arguable.
I don't know that we're going to take and resolve this issue here, so why don't we take and move on to the next question. Dr. Chung?
Yeah, Cho Chung from Korea International Trade Association. Actually, my question was a little bit related to his question, because we also heard something about the wall pool from Congressman Sandlevin. So my question is that in your associations, there could be some the companies that are concerned about the Korea's market access, the openness, the question mark. But to me, his case was long time ago. In the 1980s, maybe 70s, we might have had certain, regulations and so on. But these days, to me, if you walk across the Seoul street, you cannot go two blocks without seeing McDonald's and all those global brands. So I don't know how many companies. How many companies do you have in your associations? As an association, how do you, resolve that kind of, conflicts, if any?
For our industry, we don't have many companies at all telling us that they have problems with Korea. We are unified as an industry and as an association, fully supporting the passage of this agreement. And I have to say, as the trade director of that association, I haven't had any companies coming to me with specific issues.
Yeah, I would say the same with our members, and we represent global competitors. We're open to the free trade. The example that I think of too, and you're talking about going back to the 70s, and Sage had mentioned trade shows. I can remember some of our members saying in the 70s that they would be exhibiting their equipment, and someone would come by and put a little marker or something on a piece of equipment, step back and take a picture, and they were scaling it and using that. And we don't see that. I mean, we're still policing and looking for that, but we've come a long way. There's going to be risk in that in the international trade, but we're fundamentally and fully supportive of the market access.
All right. Well, Amy right here.
Are you saying that his experience is an anomaly among your members, or you're just saying it's such a small percentage that it's not particularly significant that there's such broad support?
Yes, yeah, so there's broad support. I mean, there are always issues with every market that we deal in. I haven't had anybody come to me with patent-specific issues in the Korean market, me personally, my members coming to me. I have had several companies come to me with patent issues in other markets, including the United States. And I've had many foreign companies come to me with patent issues in the United States. That said, I haven't heard anything Korea-specific. There tend to be more non-tariff barriers and tariff barriers, some of the things that I mentioned. And as a whole, the industry and our association supports the passage of trade agreements.
Yeah, Eric.
This is a question for Sage and Nick. Do you share Frank's optimism that the two major issues can be resolved by the G20, and what's the basis of that optimism if you do share it?
I do share it. Probably my basis is Frank was saying that, you know, Frank involved. That gives me some encouragement. Again, I just think that you know, as I had said in my remarks too, that this is an opportunity to stand up for trade, you know, with the administration. And I think from what I'm hearing within the administration, with on Capitol Hill, I mean, there's dust to settle after the election, that this is primed, will be primed and hopefully be considered by the end of the year.
I'm cautiously optimistic as well. I've been outside of the building for a few years now, so, but I go back and forth. The fact that the directive came from the president himself is what gives me the optimism. I haven't seen that yet and before. We've seen it come from a Republican president to a Democratic Congress, then you have reason to not be optimistic. We've seen it the other way around. But for the president now to say, I want this done, and especially to me with the largest and most contentious one on the table, that was an interesting move. I mean, had he said, I want Panama, then, you know, but to take Korea first and really make a move on that one, that signaled something pretty strong to me. I was also very interested back, you know, several months ago when the case came out against Guatemala on labor. I thought that was very crafty, but they're starting to enforce some labor provisions. Because it seems to me that a case is being built that you can actually enforce some of these provisions that the labor unions and others are having problems with. And I'd like to see more of that, frankly. I mean, that's part of the reason why these agreements work, is because we can protect not just our economy and workers, but those in foreign countries who are being abused. And I think by taking some of those, what may seem smaller steps in smaller markets like Guatemala and some of these other trade agreements, the signal is that we hear you, and hopefully there is some nod to those groups. And coming from the president himself, and I believe what Frank said is right, that if he goes to the Hill and says, this is mine now and I want it done, he'd probably be in big trouble if they didn't do it.
All right, well, if there's no other questions, please join me in thanking Nick and Sage.